It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Coming up, we'll meet Dr. Kendra Bogus, the new president of Concord University.
Every institution of higher ed is made up of talented, wise, good people who are really interested in the best interests of students. But one of the things we are not really good at is change. And change has come to higher ed.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Communities are learning about a 550-mile natural gas pipeline that might be coming through the state. Dominion Resources is sponsoring a series of informational gatherings, one of which was last evening in Lewis County. Glennis Board reports.
The open house-style meeting gave landowners and area residents an opportunity to informally learn about the project. A half a dozen Dominion representatives, engineers, and contractors made themselves available for questions, passed out maps. Chair of the West Virginia Sierra Club, Jim Sconyers, attended the meeting to pass out leaflets and voice environmental concerns over the pipeline. The course runs through the Monongahela National Forest. He says groups like his aren't just concerned about breaking up fragile ecosystems, but the challenges with the terrain also pose safety concerns.
They're talking about putting this pipeline up and down 4,000 and 4,500-foot mountains. The potential for accident, destruction through erosion, crossing major, numerous of our streams and rivers, is just too much to consider.
The proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline would begin in Harrison County and then cut southeast through Lewis, Upshur, Randolph, and Pocahontas counties on its way to Virginia. It would then split on the Virginia-North Carolina border. The main pipe turns south, continuing into North Carolina, and a second branch turns east and leads to Norfolk, Virginia. The capacity of the pipeline is projected to be 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day. Dominion says the project could create more than 17,000 jobs, 3,000 of those in West Virginia. Most would be temporary construction jobs, but the increase in demand that could come with the pipeline reaching new customers could lead to more jobs on drilling sites. Dominion spokesperson Chet Wade says it'll take at least 4 years to see the project completed.
First, we have about a two-year regulatory approval process. It's a very thorough process headed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but many of the state agencies are involved, local governments involved in that approval process. Ultimately, once we get that approval, it's another 2 years then for construction. It would be done in sections, and we would expect it to be in service by the end of 2018.
Last night's meeting was the first of two in West Virginia. The second is scheduled for September 24th in Durbin in Pocahontas County. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Most reporters are not scientists. Instead, we rely on the type of scientist who is good at telling stories, good at translating what happens in the lab to people who may not have been around an Erlenmeyer flask since high school. So what makes a scientist a good communicator? State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips looks at how the scientific community has become more interested in figuring that out.
Okay, what if you heard?
The change in net irradiance at the tropopause after allowing for stratospheric temperatures to readjust to radiative equilibrium.
Are you following? Me neither. But what if he said?
The sun shines down on Earth, warming our oceans, burning our skin, heating the asphalt. The numbers suggest more and more the heat is getting absorbed by the Earth and its inhabitants, and less is being reflected out into space. This makes the Earth hotter.
Well, now you know I'm describing global warming. Scientists face a struggle all the time. How to talk about their work in a way that everyone gets, but remains true to the science. And how not to wince the next day when the headlines miss the nuances in what they tried to say. 29-year-old Christina Love teaches physics at Drexel University. During her years of science education, she got no formal training in how to communicate with non-scientists. And that's not unusual.
So this is kind of the current model of our galaxy. So you see these beautiful pictures of our galaxy. One model shows for dark matter that the galaxy's deep way down in this huge spherical halo of dark matter. We're surrounded by it. And so it's here, but you can't detect it. And that's the idea.
Love is in a room full of scientists at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Center City, Philadelphia. They're standing around posters explaining their work. Get-togethers like this are something scientists do all the time with other scientists. But this time, this event is open to the public. And scientific jargon, it's discouraged. Love organized this event called Start Talking Science to coax scientists to talk about their work in a more accessible way to non-experts.
When I first learned about dark matter, I was an undergraduate at Westchester, and I really wanted to scream. I thought, how is this possible? How have I not known this up until now? I went through all of, you know, my grade school and high school thinking we know everything, and it turns out what we know is less than 5% of the entire universe. So there's just some really amazing things out there that that everyone deserves to know and understand.
In the last 10 years, major scientific societies have begun holding workshops on communications. Some have even established big money prizes to promote the idea. Naomi Oreskes teaches the history of science at Harvard, and she's written extensively about funding for climate change skeptics.
There's definitely been a change from a feeling 10 years ago that it was the job of scientists to do the science, as well and as accurately as possible, but that it was really someone else's job to communicate it. And most scientists I knew and I talked to really thought it was your job, that it was the job of science journalists. And scientists used to get mad because they felt that science journalists did a poor job.
Oreskes says controversies around politically charged topics such as climate change have led a lot of scientists to rethink how they talk about their work. If the science is complicated, she says, it's a delicate art to simplify without dumbing it down.
I always like to say it's not dumbing it down, it's cleaning it up, right? But how to make that clean up, how to sort of polish it and make it presentable in a way that's not misleading, it's not trivial.
She says one of the best science communicators to emerge from the lab into the public sphere is this guy.
We have to accept that we don't live in a world where scientists can simply do the science, publish it, and assume that it will translate to good public policy. It doesn't work that way.
That's Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann. If he sounds like he's on the warpath for better science communication, he is.
We have to be out there defending the science, informing the electorate, explaining the science and its implications, because if we don't, it means special interests, front groups, paid attack dogs will simply poison the discussion with misinformation and disinformation.
Mann's views are shaped by personal experience. In 1998, he co-authored a paper that looked at weather patterns from medieval times by analyzing ice cores and tree rings. And in this paper was a simple little graph, one he thought pretty uninteresting. But the graph communicated his findings so well, so easily to a lay audience that it got a lot of press. Then he became a top target for those who claim climate change is a hoax. He was called before Congress. His emails were hacked. At one point, in a national magazine, he was referred to as the, quote, Jerry Sandusky of climate change.
I never envisioned that majoring in physics and applied math and going into the study of the climate system would place me at the center of, you know, what may be the most contentious debate that we have faced as a society. I didn't sign up for that.
But now man has embraced it. That iconic chart is now known as the hockey stick graph. It shows how the average temperature of the Earth has risen dramatically since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Mann wrote a book on his experiences, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Mann says back before the famous graph, he was pretty naive and just wanted to stay in his lab doing nerdy calculations. He's now an advocate for scientists to get out of their bunkers and engage the public.
And part of that is using metaphors and thinking, trying to get outside of your own scientific comprehension of the issue and think about how, you know, how would I think about this if I wasn't a climate scientist, if I wasn't a scientist at all?
Mann says the challenges include widespread misconceptions about the scientific process.
We don't prove things in science. We establish, you know, best explanations for observed phenomena. We apply, you know, weights of evidence. We pose hypotheses, and then we look at the observations and we see if they support the hypotheses. And it's this iterative process. There are huge uncertainties at the base of every area of science. That doesn't mean that we know nothing.
Mann and Oreskes, the Harvard professor, agree that the problem for scientists is not just a lack of skill or comfort with public speaking. Science sits at the center of many major public policy debates. Economic interests on both sides look for science that supports their position and will attack findings that don't. That point is not lost on younger scientists like physicist Christina Love.
It's almost a fear of not explaining it properly and then all of a sudden becoming the next controversy. So you kind of see that with evolution and with climate change, and at the risk of getting cosmologists in trouble, I don't really feel like the Big Bang Theory is attacked all that much. And I don't really understand why it isn't.
Maybe the explanation is that even though some think the Big Bang conflicts with the Bible, the theory doesn't really threaten anyone's livelihood. Yet. I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:41. This morning, becoming mostly sunny today, temperatures in the 60s and 70s. Fog developing overnight again, with lows in the 40s and 50s. Mostly sunny on Friday. There is a slight chance of rain in the eastern mountains. Temperatures remaining in the 60s and 70s. The outlook for the weekend, mostly sunny skies. Temperatures in the 60s, 70s, and low 80s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit WVDRS.org for employer services.
Concord University is marking a new era with the inauguration of the 12th president this weekend. Events begin today with a presidential portrait unveiling of Dr. Kendra Bogus, a former business division chair with more than three decades of service at Concord in academics and administration. Bogus was born in Iowa but grew up in Florida. She's a first-generation college graduate who's worked since the age of 15. Jessica Lilly recently spoke with Dr. Bogus about the future of Concord University.
How do you feel about being named the first female president at Concord University?
Well, I joined some other female presidents here in West Virginia, so I'm glad to know that it's not that unusual anymore to be female and to be a president. I hope that by the end of my tenure, people will call me president and not be noticing so much that I'm a female.
Lots of students at Concord are also first-generation college students. Do you think your background helps you to relate to these students?
I absolutely think that it does. I think the difference now, and I've been at a recent conference where we compared our debt loads when we left, people my age versus young people today, and there were young people there that owed $80,000 for four-year degrees. Mm-hmm. When I finished, I didn't owe really much of anything. And I didn't have to borrow a lot of money. But today, the circumstances are really quite different, and more of a family's income is used up by loans. So I think one of the things we do really well here at Concord is we try to find scholarships for students, and over 75% of our students get some kind of help. So that's the difference, I think. But, yeah. I think I do relate to them because I am first generation, and I think a lot of us who are first generation don't really know what we want to do, and we really don't know how to do it in college.
How do you think your business background will help you as the new leader of this university?
Well, I think that we're in some really competitive times. The modalities for teaching and the modalities of offering courses is so different. It used to be that most colleges that were four-year, like Concord liberal arts institutions, were residential. Only about a third of our students live on campus today. And that's similar to other schools in the state. Because of that, we just have more challenges. We have in the state, we have private schools, we have online schools. They were not here before, even 5 years ago, that we weren't competing with those same types of schools. So I think it's really important that we have a good sense of where we stand fiscally. I think that I bring that fiscal look at things. But I still do believe that a liberal arts institution, it's kind of like medicine. We are both an art and a science. We have both sides of that. And so we have to be respectful of the idea that what we do is different than business. We don't make widgets. We help students to develop and to grow and to become the kind of people that will be good citizens, that will represent themselves and their families well in the world. It's a different dynamic, but there are certainly business models that we need to look at to make sure that we stay fiscally sound.
So what do you think are Concord's greatest challenges?
Well, right now, I think it's got to do with competition, with making sure that we're offering the kind of things that students need and want to learn. I think it also has to do with growth. We need to grow our programs, and we need to probably develop some flexibility in what we do. Many schools today are offering things like certificates, a program that has five classes in X, or continuing ed for professionals. And we haven't done too much of that. We're beginning to. We have a five-class certificate in recreation tourism management now, and I think it's a good model for what we could do in some other areas as well. So I think we have a great deal of potential, and I think growth is one of the key words for what we want to do as we go forward.
Where do you see Concord in 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think that every institution of higher ed is made up of talented, wise, good people who are really interested in the best interests of students. But one of the things we are not really good at is change, and change has come to higher ed. And so I think we have to gently find ways to look at what we do and nudge people to think about new ways that we can do them. And we've got so many really, really bright people. I don't think that's hard. I think it's a matter of having it be everyone's idea, not my idea. I'm not going to run riot over people if they don't. But I think they need to start looking at what's going on beyond the place and think of ways that they can develop modalities that students want to embrace today. Young people like you, you're looking for something different than might have happened years ago. And while we all respect the traditions here, and for me, I love the classroom. I love to go in and talk to students and read their faces, which I think I'm pretty good at. So I know if they got a concept that I've just presented, and I can stop and back up if they didn't get it. But now that's being taught on, those things are being taught in other ways. And so we want to make sure that we have a balance of the old and the new, and that we're respectful of what we did in the past, which has been very successful, and it's provided a lot of people really, really good foundations and backgrounds for their careers.
Anything else you want to add?
I would like to say that I'm just very, very honored to be given the opportunity, and I'm going to work really, really hard. I'm a hard worker, but I'll work really, really hard to make the best of the position that I can and to help Concord move forward.
Dr. Bogus, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, Dr. Kendra Bogus will address faculty and staff at what is believed to be the first ever State of the University address at Concord. The official inauguration ceremony is set for Saturday morning.
West
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at @WVPublicNews and find us on Facebook. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.